We are talking today with Anthony Arnov. Anthony Arnov is a freelance editor, writer, and activist based in Brooklyn. He worked for 7 years as an editor and publisher with South End Press. He is currently on the editorial board of Haymarket Books. His writings have appeared in the Financial Times, The Nation, Mother Jones, Left Business Observer, In These Times, and Z Magazine. He is the co-author, along with Howard Zinn, of the book Voices of a People's History of the United States, and he is here to talk about his new book, Iraq, The Logic of Withdrawal. Start out and tell us, what was the motivation in writing your book, Iraq, The Logic of Withdrawal?
Well, I was inspired by a book that the historian Howard Zinn wrote in 1967 called Vietnam, The Logic of Withdrawal. And when I was at South End Press, the publishing house you mentioned, I had the opportunity to republish that book, which had gone out of print. It was originally published by Beacon Press and had a significant impact on the anti-war movement when it came out, in terms of making an argument at that time that the only solution to the crisis in Vietnam was immediate withdrawal, which was a minority position but eventually became the position of the anti-war movement as a whole. And unfortunately, the war continued with tragic consequences for many years after Howard's very compelling and very prescient argument that the U.S. had to get out of Vietnam. And I republished that book in the year 2002, and then when the United States invaded Iraq in 2003, I kept being struck by how many of the arguments Howard was making applied to the situation in Iraq, and really felt an urgency of providing a bit of a historical perspective about what was happening in Iraq. But also, I found myself in interesting situations where people I was speaking to who had opposed the invasion began to feel that, well, it was wrong to go into Iraq, but now that the United States is there, they can't pull out. Somehow this occupation, which is causing so much harm and suffering, has to become something that will rebuild Iraq or provide stability or security or democracy there. And really, I felt those arguments rested on some very poor assumptions and a lack of historical perspective. And I wanted to follow the model of what Howard did during the Vietnam War to make the case that immediate withdrawal really was the only logical solution to the crisis in Iraq.
In some ways, it's intriguing because I don't think there was like a lot of logic that got us in there in the first place. Maybe you could
definitely not
could go over some of the reasons.
Sure. First of all, when I say the logic of withdrawal, I'm not appealing to George Bush or the Congress. I don't think they're going to see the logic. I think it's about ordinary people seeing the logic and putting pressure on their elected leaders to pull out. So the logic, I think, is a logic that I hope that the large majority of people who now oppose this war are beginning to see and that they'll act on. But in terms of why the United States went into Iraq, it had nothing to do with the stated reasons. The stated reasons were weapons of mass destruction. Iraq was repeatedly invoked in connection with Al-Qaeda and with the attacks of 9/11. Iraq was described as this dangerous threat to U.S. interests, in fact, an imminent threat to the United States. And the idea was that by invading Iraq, the United States was preventing a terrorist attack, making the world safer, stopping weapons of mass destruction. The reality is the United States intervened in Iraq for completely different reasons. All of those arguments that they used have fallen apart. There are no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, no connection to Al-Qaeda. It's now even increasingly coming out that people in the CIA and other intelligence agencies were saying that the evidence for the war was bogus. Those people were silenced, marginalized, punished, driven out of office in some cases. But the real reasons have to do with oil and geography. The fact is Iraq has the world's second largest oil reserves. It sits in a region with two-thirds of world oil reserves, and it sits in a region with increasingly important natural gas reserves. So the United States saw an opportunity after 9/11 to advance a series of objectives that it had long before 9/11 that have nothing to do with stopping terrorism but have to do with asserting American control over the energy resources of the Middle East and using that control to project power globally. And they saw an opportunity to describe that offensive project in defensive terms after 9/11. And the other thing, of course, that's important is the United States wants to have military bases in the Middle East. they've lost their military bases in Saudi Arabia, and they saw an opportunity by overthrowing the government of Iraq, not only of getting greater control over the energy resources of that region, but of establishing a firm military presence there that could be used for greater projection of power in the region.
You mentioned earlier a historical perspective. Maybe you can give us a little bit of that now. That seems that in the corporate media, when they're talking about Iraq, they seem to forget everything that happened prior to the last U.S. invasion in 91.
Well, even if they go back to that, I mean, most of the history begins in 2003. But, you know, we do need to go back. First of all, we need to go back to the 12-plus years that Iraq was subjected to sanctions. The sanctions were done in the name of the United Nations, but it was really the United States and United Kingdom who were the main backers of those sanctions. During those 12 years, the United States and United Kingdom were also periodically bombing Iraq. And as the Downing Street memos reveal, there was a plan to sharply escalate the bombing of Iraq in the year leading up to the invasion. So really, the attack on Iraq began not in March 2003, but a year before that, with attacks that certainly violated international law. They were hoping to provoke Iraq into attacking a U.S. target and then using that as the pretext for war. It didn't happen, so then they had to come up with other pretexts. But the sanctions had a devastating impact on Iraq, and they also created a hostility and a resentment of the Iraqi people, a suspicion of the Iraqi people towards claims of the United States to be liberators. The Shia population of Iraq recall that in 1991, President George Herbert Walker Bush, George Bush's papa, encouraged them to rise up against Saddam Hussein. They did, and they were then allowed to be slaughtered. The United States just stood to the side and let Saddam Hussein crush the rebellion because they preferred a stable, strong man in Iraq to the alternative, which they didn't necessarily control. They didn't have another strong man to put in his place. Before that, the United States was an ally of Saddam Hussein. That's a very important fact to recall. Many of the crimes that the Iraqi government committed that were used to justify the invasion of Iraq were committed with the support and backing of the United States, using weapons supplied by U.S. companies or the U.S. military directly. Donald Rumsfeld met with Saddam Hussein, shook his hand. A number of U.S. politicians did the same. He was an ally, and in fact, Saddam Hussein would never have risen to power through the Ba'ath Party power structure, and the Ba'ath Party itself would not necessarily have risen to power if it hadn't been for support from the United States, which saw the Ba'ath Party as a bulwark against communism. There was a strong secular communist party in Iraq. The Ba'ath Party slaughtered 5,000 members of that party and allies, trade unionists, women, women's group leaders, and so on, using lists supplied by the CIA. And the U.S. has a long history there, and it's not just there, but in the Middle East, not of supporting democracy, but of supporting repressive regimes and discouraging the growth of democracy in the region, because democratic movements in that region tend to have a nationalist character and tend to demand things like nationalization of oil, which is quite contrary to the interests of the United States.
So then we move forward to the U.S. invasion and occupation, and that is turning out quite different than expected by the administration.
Absolutely. Remember, there's a whole series of claims that were made. This would be a quick occupation. The Iraqis would greet us as liberators. They would greet us with sweets and flowers, in the word of one Iraqi exile who was very influential in the buildup for the scenario of the invasion. They said that the occupation would pay for itself because Iraqi oil would start flowing immediately. The Iraqis would stop fighting on behalf of the Iraqi government, but would turn sides and fight alongside the United States against the Iraqi government, and that Iraq would become a beacon of democracy in the Middle East as part of this wave of democratization in the region. And, you know, none of those things has borne out, and in fact, the anti-war movement predicted ahead of time that none of those things would happen. We predicted that the Iraqis would see us as occupiers, not as liberators, which is what has happened. We predicted that the war would be costly, both in terms of the economic costs of this war, but also in terms of the loss of human life that it would bring about. And the occupation is now 3 years old, and every day it gets worse. The violence increases. The situation for ordinary Iraqis is miserable. They have less electricity less access to safe drinking water. Unemployment has skyrocketed. People are afraid to send their children to school. People are afraid to leave their homes. Violence has increased drastically. And the United States has fueled sectarian divisions in that country. And it has emboldened quite reactionary fundamentalist forces that gained legitimacy partly because of the sanctions, which created such misery in the country that it encouraged a turn towards Islamism in a very secular, advanced, modern country, but also because those groups have been able to use opposition to the occupation as a rallying call and an organizing principle. So the occupation, rather than lessening the likelihood of civil war, has greatly increased it.
Talk about the reasons for why you see we need immediate withdrawal. If you listen to the opposition party in the U.S., which currently is the Democrats, they seem pretty unanimous in that we can't cut and run. We have to hang in there until whatever is achieved.
I think it's not really accurate to call the Democrats an opposition party. They're not even really a loyal opposition. They're engaged in a tactical debate with the Republicans over how best to occupy Iraq. But the reality is there's no good way to occupy another country. Hillary Clinton, Joe Lieberman calling for more troops to be sent into Iraq, as if that's the problem. We don't have enough troops there. The reality is the troops are causing the resistance. The troops are creating instability. The troops are contributing to a situation in which there's not a legitimate Iraqi government. The people see those people who are in the process of forming a government in Iraq, and they see that those people are accountable to and dependent on the United States, that they're making deals with the United States about long-term military bases, that they're making deals with the United States about oil in contradiction to the interests of the Iraqi people. They don't want the Iraqi military to be a tool of the United States. They don't want military bases, and they don't want the oil of the country going to benefit the West rather than benefiting Iraqis. So the situation is tremendously unstable, and the reality is the longer the U.S. stays, the worse it's going to get. We've been told over and over and over again, we've turned a corner. Remember, you know, we said, well, once we capture Saddam Hussein, then things will get better in Iraq. And then they captured Saddam Hussein, and then that didn't make things better. And then they said, well, once we get rid of Ba'ath Party influence in the government, that will take care of things, and that didn't do it. And then they said, okay, well, look, we don't want to have elections, but we've been pressured into having elections. Once we have those elections, things will get better. And things continued to decline after the elections. And they said, well, once a stable government forms, all these benchmarks that they've created, none of them have led to an improvement of the situation. And the reality is the occupation distorts every aspect of Iraqi society. And until we remove the occupation, that will continue to be the case. And it will continue to be the case that these sectarian conflicts will be fueled by the arms of the United States. And the United States has been arming Shia militias, and it's been using classic colonial divide and rule strategies. And as long as they're there, they'll continue to do that.
So maybe you can address a couple of the reasons that you'll hear in the media for staying there, even though you just gave a good overall picture. For instance, the idea of we just have to hang in there a little longer to bring democracy to the country.
Sure. Yeah, this is the new lie. You know, the first big lie of this war was weapons of mass destruction. The new big lie is democracy. Well, look, if we believed in democracy, then why don't we ask the Iraqi people what they want? The Iraqi people have said overwhelmingly, it's in polling, it's been established through a number of polls, including polls done by the British government and the U.S. government, that the Iraqi people don't welcome the U.S. occupation. They oppose it. The Iraqi people also support attacks on the U.S. occupation, even if those are violent attacks. So they object to the occupation. They want to have a say in the formation of their own government without foreign interference. The other thing that the Iraqi people say is that they would like the oil resources of the country to go for Iraqi development in a kind of federalized structure rather than what the United States has put in place through the Constitution that they drafted, which is a radically federalized structure in which the oil resources are distributed unevenly. Oil in Iraq is concentrated in the north in the predominantly Kurdish region, and in the south in the predominantly Shia region. And through that federalized structure, the Sunni, who are predominantly concentrated in the center of the country, where there aren't concentrations of oil, face the prospect of a future without that kind of economic resource, without job opportunities, without economic development. It's a recipe for civil war. And so the reality is that this occupation is the negation of democracy. Occupations always are about imposing the will of a foreign power on another power. That's the opposite of democracy.
Well, you mentioned civil war. Many people are saying if we pull out now, the country will erupt into civil war.
Well, the reality is the country may erupt into civil war when the United States pulls out because of what we've set into motion. I think that the chances of civil war increase greatly the longer the United States stays, rather than decreasing. The Constitution defines political power in terms of sectarian divisions. The United States has armed Shia militias that have been carrying out attacks on Sunnis, often using the cover of the Interior Ministry, the government, the legitimate military posts to carry out these attacks. The United States has also brought into Iraq, into positions of power, the Dawah Party, the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq, parties that are defined in highly sectarian terms and that are undermining secular, undermining democratic possibilities in Iraq. And so if we want to lessen the possibility of civil war, one, we've got to remove the completely distorting presence of the United States. And then two, we have to take away all of the resolutions and laws that were imposed by the United States that have so federalized power in Iraq and that have defined power in these sectarian ways.
What about those that say we can't, and there's variations on this, we can't cut and run, it will only show a weak stance from the United States and encourage further terrorist attacks?
Well, the reality is the United States is encouraging terrorism by its presence in Iraq. The United States has fueled tremendous anger and resentment, not only in Iraq, but around the world. Al-Qaeda of Iraq did not exist before the U.S. intervention there. It does now. Growth of recruitment for groups like Al-Qaeda has been significant in recent years because they can point to the U.S. invasion of Iraq. They can point to Abu Ghraib, the images of torture and abuse. They can point to the fact that the United States seems to many people around the world to be engaged in a war on Islam. And that has fueled the kind of anger and resentment and hostility and frustration that leads people not only to join those kinds of organizations, but to want to target the United States and its allies. Madrid and London were both targeted for terrorist attacks because of their alliance with the United States in invading Iraq. So the United States is not lessening the threat of terrorism. It's fueling the threat of terrorism by being in Iraq. The sooner it gets out, the sooner it can begin to change course, not just in Iraq, but more globally. The U.S. is a target because of its invasion of Iraq, but also because of its support for Israeli occupation of Palestinian lands and its support for a series of repressive regimes in the Middle East and in Asia and elsewhere as well that have repressed their populations, denied democracy to their populations. That's what makes us vulnerable, not because people hate our freedoms or they hate democracy.
Another of the we can't cut and run options is we can't do so because it will dishonor the sacrifice of the soldiers who have already died there.
Yeah, this is George Bush's common refrain. We have to honor the sacrifice of those who died by continuing the mission that they died for. Well, first of all, the soldiers may have had many motivations for going into Iraq. I suspect that they had to do with the stated reasons that we were somehow stopping a horrible dictator with weapons of mass destruction who was a threat to the United States, that we were bringing democracy, that we were freeing people from oppression. But many soldiers have now concluded the opposite. That's not what they were doing. 72% of soldiers in a recent Zogby poll said that they want to get out of Iraq. groups like Iraq Veterans Against War have formed. Soldiers are speaking out. Pablo Paredes, Camilo Mejia, a number of people declaring conscientious objection, saying, I'm not going to fight and die for oil. I'm not going to fight and die for empire. And the reality is, these people have died needlessly. The 2,400 U.S. soldiers have died needlessly. All of the Iraqis that have died needlessly. And to compound those deaths is only to compound the tragedy. To have one more person die for a lie is only to compound the tragedy of those who have already sacrificed their lives for this unjust and illegal war.
And one final reason for why we need to stay there that I don't actually hear from the administration, but I actually read fairly regularly in letters to the editor, is that we need to stay there and fight them on their turf, or we'll be fighting them here in the United States.
Absolutely. This is a thing you hear often. Fight them over there, kill them there, rather than risk the idea that they might come and attack us here in the United States. What this rests on, again, is a connection between Iraq and 9/11. There was no connection between Iraq and 9/11. It was a false claim that was used to sell war to a skeptical public and to manipulate people's fear and anxiety and anger over 9/11. We are creating more terrorists in Iraq. We're fueling recruitment, as I suggested, for terrorist organizations. But we're also using terrorism against the Iraqi people. The siege of Fallujah involved seizing Fallujah General Hospital. That was the first action of that intervention. We're engaged in war crimes in Iraq. This idea that the United States stops terrorism by violating the Geneva Conventions, violating international law, invading other countries, is completely illusory. The United States is only making the world more dangerous, and in fact is also making the world more dangerous in another important way, which is to fuel the development of nuclear weapons around the world. Because people look at the United States invasion of Iraq and they see that the U.S. invaded Iraq not because it had weapons of mass destruction, but because it did not. They didn't have a deterrent to U.S. power. And so countries around the world are racing to develop that deterrent, and that certainly explains the situation with regard to what's happening now in Iran. And the escalating rhetoric around Iran is very worse indeed. You go back to the Vietnam War. The war in Vietnam was decisively over by 1968 in terms of the ability of the United States to impose its will on the Vietnamese people. The Tet Offensive proved decisively that the United States had lost the war. But the conflict continued and expanded into Laos and Cambodia. And we have to take very seriously the threat that this administration would expand the war into Iran.
All right. So I believe you stated early on that you didn't expect our elected officials to take the lead on this. What do you see needs to happen?
Well, I see a number of people taking a lead around the issue of Iraq. I mentioned Camilo Mejia and Pablo Paredes. It's very important that soldiers themselves are speaking out or organizing. If you go back to the Vietnam War, that was a crucial element to ending that war. There was a rebellion within the ranks of the U.S. military. People don't know that history, but it's very eloquently described in a new film called Sir, No Sir, which has just been released, that documents that rebellion, and in a book called Soldiers in Revolt by David Courtwright with a new introduction by Howard Zinn. So I'm very encouraged by those people who are organizing within the ranks of the military to oppose this war. I'm also really encouraged by the military families. A while ago in Seattle, Cindy Sheehan spoke. Cindy Sheehan has provided tremendous courage and leadership to the anti-war movement. She lost her son, Casey, on April 4th, 2004, in Iraq, and she has spoken out ever since. Specifically, has very effectively countered that idea that there was a noble cause that her son died for and that we have to continue that mission to honor her son's sacrifice. And she and others have formed Gold Star Families for Peace, military families organizations that are also organizing very effectively against the war. Then on campuses and in communities around the country, there's been a burgeoning counter-recruitment movement challenging the lies that the military tells to get people into the military. Military recruitment is down significantly. They have not had such a hard time getting people to join the military since just after the Vietnam War. And particularly, they've had a sharp decline in African-American and Latino recruitment, which I think is significant. People are understanding the racist character of this war and the connection between the war abroad and a war at home and working at poor people. There's also groups forming among trade unions, like U.S. Labor Against War, New York Labor Against War. This is happening much earlier than happened during the Vietnam War. And all of these grassroots efforts come together. In Wisconsin, 24 communities passed Out Now resolutions. In Seattle, there's a Proposition 86, to challenge recruitment in public schools and parks. The Seattle Parent Teacher Association at Garfield High School passed a resolution against recruitment. San Francisco passed counter-recruitment initiatives. These things can come together and provide the kind of bottom-up leadership that can force pressure politicians to do something that right now they seem completely unwilling to contemplate, which is get out of Iraq and stop squandering so much money on this war, money that could be far better spent on education, healthcare in this country, veterans programs in this country, which have been badly cut, and ultimately also on reparations to the Iraqi people, who certainly deserve reparations after all the harm and suffering we've caused them.
Then, beyond just this current war in Iraq, do you see a bigger picture that needs to be addressed here?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I think Iraq is a symptom. It's a symptom of a drive for empire, which expresses itself in a number of ways. It expresses itself in the possibility of war with Iran. It expresses itself in U.S. intervention in Latin America, most recently with the U.S. effort to support a coup attempt in Venezuela. And it connects itself to the fact that the U.S., in order to maintain this global empire, is spending hundreds of billions of dollars, trillions of dollars, really, to maintain military bases in some 170 countries around the world. And this is fueling globally resentment and anger, but it's also taking an enormous toll at home. The war abroad is connected with a war on civil liberties in this country that is quite alarming. The government has asserted a whole series of privileges of executive power to wiretap, to survey, to infiltrate peaceful organizations, to investigate without warrant, to wiretap without warrant, and we should be very concerned about that. It's also connected with a lowering down of the standards of torture globally. The United States has basically asserted a right to torture, a right to engage in cruel and inhumane treatment. And the United States has also expanded this doctrine of preemptive war. But there's a contradiction. The United States is saying it alone can use these policies. It alone can use this doctrine. Well, the world doesn't work that way. Israel has asserted the right. Russia has asserted the right. China has asserted the right to use preemptive strikes. Pakistan and India, two nuclear powers, have also asserted that right. So we're setting in place an escalation of the likelihood of war, an escalation of the likelihood of nuclear war. And once you start talking about that, you really start talking about whether or not the species will survive. I think that the path that Washington has set us down, it's not just the Republicans, it's the Democrats and the Republicans, is leading towards a completely unsustainable future. So it's in Iraq, we have to not only get out of Iraq, but I think we have to make that part of a reversal of course. You know, you go back to Martin Luther King, when he spoke out against the Vietnam War, he said in his Riverside Church speech of April 4, 1967, you can't separate war from racism, you can't separate war from economic exploitation. These are the triple evils we confront. And he was getting at the root of war and a drive for dominating other resources, dominating other people, dominating other markets, controlling other people, and the racism that's necessary to do that. And unless we start really addressing those triple evils that Martin Luther King talked about, I think really we're down a path where we don't have much time left to reverse course, where we're going to have less and less time to push towards a more sustainable way of supplying our energy needs, push towards a more sustainable way of meeting our needs as a society, and certainly a more sustainable way of dealing with conflict in our world.
I'd like to thank you for spending time with us today.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
just been talking with Anthony Arnove. He is author of the new book, Iraq, The Logic of Withdrawal. And again, you can find out more information about the tour at the website endthewartour.org.